Well, I'm looking forward to this chat with Steve Shippey. He is a filmmaker, paranormal expert. I'll tell you a little bit more about Steve when we come back in a moment. But he has been diving into the paranormal for years, and he'll tell you all about it. And I got to tell you, if some of you are faint of heart, you might want to just pull the blankets up to your chin or turn down the radio, because you're going to hear some things that could scare you. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Steve Shippey. He's a filmmaker, paranormal expert. He's a pro there, a host of the Travel Channel's Haunting in the Heartland. He grew up in a small town near Saginaw, Michigan, and he literally was the kid living in a creepy house on the corner. He is a victim of a severe haunting. He'll tell us about that. Actually witnessed several apparitions. After investigating his own haunting situation, he discovered a shocking truth. The previous owners had been brutally murdered there. Shippey has produced and directed a number of feature-length documentaries, at least 10, including A Haunting on Hamilton Street, A Haunting on Dice Road, and A Haunting on Brockway Street, where he investigates haunted locations to uncover the truth. Steve, welcome to the program again, and we look forward to chatting with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
How are things in Saginaw? I grew up in Detroit, so not too far away from you.
Yeah, not too far away at all. It's actually pretty nice right now. We're kind of defrosting.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's a great state. I love it. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay. I thought I lost you for a moment back here. I'm in St. Louis right now, hunkered down in my bunker, to be sure. But how did you get involved in this? Was it this haunting situation that got to you?
Yeah, definitely. As far as what led me down the paranormal path, it was definitely the experiences that I had growing up. I feel that I kind of often say to people that I feel when somebody has a very unique experience with the paranormal, when you know for a fact you've encountered something of this kind, I think there's kind of two ways you can go. One, you can kind of tuck tail, go the other way, hope it never happens again, or you basically become kind of consumed and intrigued by it. You know, what is this? How could this be? It kind of leads you on a quest wanting to know more.
Tell us about the situation that you were involved in when you were smaller, and then we'll get into the crazy situation of Ed Gein.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the haunting in the house where I grew up in, it I was very young when it, you know, obviously when this happened. So kind of going back to my first memories of, you know, really understanding it was, I guess you could say, some of the smaller things at first. You know, things would come up missing, and, you know, I would hear the family kind of arguing about it. You know, where did this go? Who did this, or who broke this? Who opened up all the cupboards? Who keeps doing that? It was, you know, rather unusual. And this kind of progressed and then ultimately got to the point where, you know, doors would start opening and slamming. Objects would move on their own. We would hear disembodied voices, that type of thing. And it didn't take long before everybody in the home, you know, basically had to acknowledge this is a real thing. This is truly happening. Back in this time frame, of course, it was a little more of a taboo subject. So you couldn't really talk much about it with your neighbors. You didn't really want to talk about it, or there was really nobody to bring in for, you know, to help like there is today. It's so much more accepted now. There's paranormal groups and mm-hmm. demonologists and so many different things, but that's kind of, where we were. And ultimately we ended up moving out of the house.
How did you unravel the fact that a couple people got murdered there?
Well, it was kind of a well-known fact, you know. I mean, you know, we knew the situation. I guess, you know, of course, at the time, I didn't. That wasn't something that, you know, my parents really wanted to talk much about, and I was really too young to kind of hear that kind of stuff. But, you know, later on, of course, you know, you start to hear everything and what happened. And there's a lot of rumors about that as well, as far as what really happened and why. A lot of people have suggested maybe at this point I go back and actually investigate the home. You know, for the longest time I said I would not do that. But I guess maybe as time goes by, maybe curiosity will eventually get the best of me.
Steve, did your parents know about the murders before they bought the house?
You know, they said that they didn't, but I kind of feel that they did.
Yeah. Why would they do that?
Well, you know, I think it's just kind of one of those things. Sometimes an opportunity presents itself when you're looking for a home on the market and the price is just right. And, you know, they were struggling at the time, no doubt,
sure,
to kind of make ends meet early on. And so I just, I just think it was the right, the right price, the right situation for the time.
And if I remember, Saginaw, it kind of lived and died by the auto industry out that way, didn't it?
Saginaw, yeah, definitely. It's kind of a, its history is kind of a boom town, way back when in the 1800s. It was actually one of the wealthiest cities in America during the lumber era. And of course, eventually they cut everything down and that went away and came back again with automotive. And right now it's more of a healthcare.
Right next to Flint, Michigan, that had those horrendous water problems. So has that gotten any better?
Sadly, it really hasn't. The story kind of went away, but yet it's still very much the same.
Steve, how did you get involved in producing documentaries and paranormal stories like that?
Well, as I continued, basically my quest into the paranormal, trying to understand it, I started doing a lot of investigating and, really kind of how it all came about at some point. I have a career as a national recording artist, and we were on tour one day, and a good friend of mine that I was touring with said, I'd like to see some of that. And I said, well, what do you mean? Well, I'd like to see your episodes. And I said, well, we don't have any episodes. We go out and investigate. We have footage. And he said, well, why don't you film that? There's a lot of people do that. Why don't you film your investigations? Don't you think people would like to see that? And I kind of thought about it, and I said, well, I think my music fan base is quite different than, what would be a fan base for that type of content, but, maybe. And I kind of thought about that, put that thought in the back of my mind, and several months later, we were embarking on a new investigation, and I just kind of thought, well, why don't we just try this? Why don't we, document it in documentary format and just see what happens? And ultimately, we did that, and when it was finished, we decided we wanted to premiere it. So we went to a local theater, and they kind of looked at us crazy, and they said, well, we have 2,000 seats here. I don't think this is the place for you. And so we looked at them, and we said, okay, well, we'll take our chances, I guess. It's only a city of 40,000 people here. And we actually ended up selling it out both nights. And then from that point, we've continued ever since. We've got 10 available and 4 more coming.
Good for you. I mean, you've been a recording artist for at least, 15 years?
Yeah, probably around 20.
Good for you. And you're a rapper by trade, aren't you?
Yeah, yep.
That's cool. That's good. And we'll talk about the music scene on another show, to be sure, but it's been changing, hasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It's ever-evolving, ever-changing, and I, really kind of feel for... for all my friends that are still doing that full time, because I can only imagine what COVID has done to that, what 2020 has done to that.
Oh my God! Now the Discovery Channel has a stream program that they just debuted on Friday of last week called Ed Gein, The Real Psycho. How did you get involved in this strange story?
Okay, well, so actually, a bizarre set of circumstances. So. I'll give you a quick version of the long story, I guess.
Okay, and then I'll have you explain who Ed Gein is to people who don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had actually ran into an individual by, pure chance at a restaurant one day, and I, kind of was hearing them talking about cameras and different things, so we kind of struck up a conversation and exchanged numbers and whatnot, and, he was in filmmaking, so was I, and then about a year later, he contacted me, and he said, hey, do you remember meeting me? I said, yeah, of course. He says, well, we've got a project coming our way regarding an individual named Ed Gein. Are you familiar? And so right away, I just started shooting off facts to this guy about Ed Gein. I've actually studied him a lot.
Wow.
And he just stopped me, and he said, okay, hold on a minute. You're the guy. Let me explain. We're looking for a paranormal investigator who is willing to take on this case and go out to Plainfield, Wisconsin. Are you in? And I said, absolutely, count me in.
Ed Gein was one strange guy. Isn't he the guy, Steve, that Silence of the Lambs kind of built its movie around?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, a lot of notable fictional characters were created off the real-life individual Ed Gein. Texas Chainsaw Massacre's Leatherface, most popular, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, Norman Bates, and of course, Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill.
Ed Gein, of course, was born in 1906 in Wisconsin. He was called the Butcher of Plainfield or the Plainfield Ghoul. He was an American convicted murderer. He was a body snatcher. His crimes committed around his hometown of Plainfield, Wisconsin, gathered widespread notoriety back in 1957 after authorities discovered that he had, this is what this guy did, exhumed corpses from local graveyards, and then he skinned them and kept their heads, and he did all kinds of crazy things, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's as you said, you know, he definitely was a murderer, a grave robber. He would exhume these corpses, bring them back to his farmhouse. And what he would do is he would go through the local obituaries and he would try to find women that he felt resembled his mother and wait for them to have their funeral and be buried. And then that night he would go out to the cemetery, exhume them, bring them back to his farmhouse, and actually take parts of their body, their skin, and other anatomy, we'll say. And he was creating a full-body skin suit in which he would dress up in,
as well as masks.
He would use human skulls and create bowls that he would eat out of, silverware made from bones, and all sorts of other macabre things.
Oh, my God. And then he confessed to killing two women himself, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, my God. And I remember the scene in Silence of the Lambs where the guy was dancing around the house with skin on him just like clothes. And so I assume that's what Gene did.
Yeah, absolutely. He would say he would go out at night so nobody would see him. I mean, he was in a really rural area anyway, but he would go out at night and just dance around the fields and was trying to emulate, in theory, we feel, after all the investigation that we did, almost like he was trying to emulate his mother in some type of way, like a split personality.
What was it about the Gene case that kind of pulled you in?
I feel that, I guess, trying to understand the incomprehensible. I guess, you know, probably a lot of the reasons why people, you know, watch documentaries on serial killers. But Gene was just such a bizarre case in so many ways. It was so gruesome. It was so out of the realm of understanding. There was no emotion there. It was, nobody really even knows what his purpose was. And I'm not even sure Gene did really understand what compelled him to do what he was doing.
I mean, his father died of heart failure when he was, what, like 34? And what was it that flipped this guy out?
You know, from our investigation, you know, when you bring up his father, you know, he was a pretty severe alcoholic. But really, I think the abuse in Gene's childhood came from his mother, Augusta Gene.
Uh-huh. Okay.
She instilled and ingrained in him at a very early age that humans were inherently evil, and particularly women. Didn't want him to have any relationships at all. Friendships really kept him isolated. And toward the end of his life, so to speak, I guess you could say, or the end of his heyday, it was just him and his mother isolated in this farmhouse. And when she finally passed away, that's when Gene just really went off the deep end.
Gene finally died at the age of 77 in the Mendota Mental Health Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. And I'm sure nobody misses the guy, Steve.
No, definitely not.
Now, when you were looking at this case, tell me, what was it that really flipped you out, that got you really scared?
You know, I think the things that I found, you know, most disturbing was the fact that, you know, when we're coming through all these reports and we're listening to the interviews from people at the time and all the locals, they're describing Gene as a rather simple man, but a very, you know, trustworthy individual. You know, good old Eddie Gene down the road, he made his living doing oddball jobs. He'd go to people's homes, they'd let him in and say, hey, you know, Eddie, if we're not here, just go ahead and come in and, you know, go ahead and fix that sink or fix that, you know, that old cabinet cupboard there. And even in the reports, it was found that Gene actually used to babysit for people in the community.
Oh, God. They actually liked the guy, didn't they?
Yeah, they really did. You know, and another thing I think that really kind of disturbed me about Gene, and you know, let me kind of, you know, get your take on this, but when one of the victims that he murdered went missing, Mary Hogan, you know, it was a, you know, small town, so that didn't just go away anytime soon. People would talk about it quite often, and he'd be at the local diner and such, and people would be saying, you know, Wonder what happened to Mary. Mary went up missing.
And she owned a bar or something, didn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's it. That's where she disappeared from. And Dean would say to people, oh, you know, she's not missing. She's at my place. She's hanging around my place. You know,
technically he was right.
Humor but in hindsight, I guess the question I have is, was it a dark sense of humor or was he just matter-of-factly saying it?
I mean, this guy could have been so whacked out, Stephen, that he probably thought she was still alive when she was dead in his house.
I definitely thought the same thing. In fact, another really, really bizarre thing about Gein is that he would have skulls arranged in the house at eye level on shelves and things, almost like they were companions to him.
You went to the house, did you not, in Plainfield, Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. We went onto the farm and the land right where the house stood, because right after Gein was arrested and there was basically a media frenzy, converging onto Plainfield, somebody went out there in the middle of the night and literally just torched the house and burnt it right to the ground.
Wow. Now, you went out there with a psychic medium, Cindy Kaza?
Yeah, Cindy Kaza, yep.
Tell me about her abilities.
You know, so this was my first time working with Cindy. I mean, of course, I knew who she was. I've seen a lot of her work. She's very reputable. But this was my first encounter working with her. What amazed me about her is, I mean, first of all, she had just a ton of senses out there. From the minute she walked out on the farm, she was having visions. She felt that Augusta, his mother, was present. A very dominating force, wanting us to leave, calling her a witch. I don't want to give away too much, but what really impressed me with Cindy is every time she would have the sense that somebody was present and she would call that out, Steve, someone is here, someone is coming up behind me right now. The meters would all start to go off within about 20 to 30 seconds, and the meters would be in the proximity of where she was saying the spirit was. In one instance particular, we were at the old Warden's Hardware store, and I have an SLS system, and I'm kind of scanning the room looking for any type of anomaly.
And Warden being where Bernice Warden was killed in 1957, she owned a hardware store.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, ultimately, what that was Ed's downfall there is when he killed and took Bernice out of the hardware store. He had gone in the hardware store the night before and made mention in front of some customers that he was going to come in the next day. And so that's basically why he became a suspect. The police went out to talk to him. He wasn't home. They let themselves in, and that's when they found her, Bernice, hanging upside down and decapitated.
Of course,
everything unraveled at that point. They found pieces of Mary Hogan and at least 10 or more corpses.
What was it like being out there on his land? Did it feel strange to you?
It definitely felt very foreboding, very ominous from the minute we got out there. I mean, of course, we have to separate the fact that, we know what happened there. So part of that, could play into the psyche. But beyond that, there really was kind of a visceral sense that something was there.
Steve Shippey with us, of course, a filmmaker, paranormal investigator. We're going to take calls with Steve next hour. Perhaps you can share your own paranormal experience with Steve and get his reaction to that. We're going to get into some of his other stories on his investigations because he's been all over the map. Boy, and I looked at a picture today of Ed Gein, Steve. He really was a creepy-looking guy.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I think the Plainfield Ghoul pretty much sums up his image perfectly.
I mean, it's unfortunate, but I'm convinced that you mold a kid when they're a child, and somebody screwed him up big time. We're going to come back with more with Steve Shippey in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Steve Shippey. We're talking with a paranormal filmmaker and investigator. How many places, Steve, do you think in your career here as a paranormal investigator have you visited?
You know, I thought about that fairly recently. I would say probably around 200.
Wow.
In that neighborhood.
That's a lot.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I've been doing it for over 20 years. Started doing the filmmaking aspect of it, documentary aspect of it, about 12 years ago.
Which one stands out as the strangest place that you've been to?
The strangest place, I would have to say, would be a haunting on Dice Road, the small town of Merrill, Michigan, right outside of Saginaw, Michigan here.
Okay, and you've done a documentary on that, haven't you?
Yes.
Tell us about this place.
Man, so I guess to sum up what really happened out there, this took place in 1974. It all started one night when this family was sleeping in this old farmhouse, and the front window smashed in as if somebody broke it out. So, of course, you know, they got up. Harold Pomeranian grabbed a shotgun. The family went outside, you know, see who was out there. Was somebody trying to break in? Couldn't find anybody, called the police. Police came out, made a report, and they thought maybe it was just some teens causing some trouble. Well, from that night, every night for over a year, the family had to continuously call the police. More windows being broken, pounding on the side of the house. Got to the point where the police started doing stakeouts. They would hear the pounding. They couldn't see anybody. Eventually, they thought, okay, and I'm just giving you the skinny notes here.
Sure.
Eventually, they thought, okay, well, it must be the family. Somehow, they're doing this, and it must be a hoax. So they started to bug the house, listen in. They brought each one of them in for a polygraph. They passed the polygraphs. Got to the point where the state police got involved and even bigger agencies than that. Eventually, the activity graduated to spontaneous combustion. Fires were happening. And the state police ultimately brought out a parapsychologist team from Duke University at the time to study the phenomenon. And while they were there, three fires happened 3 days in a row, one of them almost burning the house to the ground.
Oh, boy. Strange stuff. And you were able to illustrate that and everything else. How do people see these documentaries, Steve?
These are available on Amazon Prime. So if you have a Prime account and you have Prime Video, you can stream them for free.
Okay, cool. And if not, you just pay a nominal fee, right? A rental fee?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, what do you think draws people to the strange, the unusual, the paranormal, the macabre? People are fascinated with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a few different things. Of course, people that have had experiences, you know, will definitely gravitate to this. But I feel that, you know, it's the unknown. It's trying to understand, you know, what they don't understand, you know, just kind of longing for the answers. And I kind of think inherently we all, as people, want to know what happens when we die, you know, what's out there, where might we end up?
You're not just a filmmaker, though. You are a diehard paranormal investigator. You mean business when you're going out on the scene, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, definitely, you know, the filmmaker side of me tries to, you know, to document everything and see it that way. But, you know, my primary interest is definitely to investigate the paranormal.
Do you use different techniques yourself and equipment?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We use a gamut of different things. You know, very, very much into audio. We use analog recording devices, digital recording devices for ITC. I have a Geoport custom made by Georgia Brown. Of course, we use the Spirit Box, things of that nature. As far as video, full spectrum, infrared, digital photographs, Polaroid photographs. You know, we tend to get different results on different forms of media in that sense. And pretty much, you know, anything that's cutting edge, and even some kind of more primitive methods we try.
Steve, what do you think of EVPs, electronic voice phenomena? Do you think they're real or some distortion or what?
I absolutely think they're real. I mean, we've had, you know, several, I mean, hundreds, I guess, at this point, EVPs over the years where, you know, to me, if you are in a room, especially if you're by yourself, I mean, at that point, you know, there's nobody else there. But when you ask a specific question, and you play it back, and you get a very specific answer to that question, and sometimes even multiple in succession as you continue that EVP session. I don't know how else you could explain that. I mean, there's clearly something there that the recorder is capturing, definitively answering your questions.
Steve, if you're like me, little kid ghosts and episodes are freaky and sad. Do you feel that same way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, there should be no reason that a child's spirit should be stuck anywhere. You know, they should be at peace and they should be, you know, in the best place possible. So whenever you hear that, it always makes you wonder, you know, why is this happening? And sometimes there's a part of you that really has to kind of wonder, Could it be something else? We know a lot of the darker spirits, I guess you could say, if you want to call them spirits, but some of the evil out there will always try to portray themselves as something innocent to kind of lure you in. So that's always something that, you know, you should think about.
Do you go out with a team of investigators, Steve?
Yeah, often I do. I mean, most of the investigations I do is with a very small team. I think we get better results. There's less contamination as far as noise and, you know, people kind of clomping around on different floors. But I definitely do have a small group that I travel with.
Do they all have a specific task or duty?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, some are more, geared toward audio purposes, some of the tech stuff. Some of them are more on the documentary side of things. They're to document everything, regardless of what happens, always having the camera and be ready for anything.
What drives you? What keeps pushing you?
You know, at this particular point, if you would have asked me that maybe 15 years ago, I think that surely I would have said, to capture evidence, proof of the paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
But after doing that time and again and for so long, not to mention there's so many other people out there investigating, that have captured so many things to further the field. But really at this point, it's more about helping people. I think that's kind of what drives me the most. That's kind of the most fulfilling part of this, is knowing that there are families out there or business owners, property owners that are scared. You know, that something is happening around them that's causing them unrest and fear, and letting them know you're not crazy and you're definitely not alone. This does happen. Let's figure out what it is, why it's happening, and see what we can do.
I'm sure you face skeptics. You may not even get a call from a skeptic tonight, Steve. Do you try to convince them, or what do you do? How do you handle that?
No, not at all. I number one, I feel that, oftentimes I say, to a skeptic, basically I'm glad you are, right? Because if you're a skeptic, that means you yourself have not had a paranormal experience that you're aware of, And maybe that's a good thing, because oftentimes, not that every paranormal experience is bad or negative, but if you're not prepared for it, if you don't understand it, it can definitely be very frightening. And it does take a toll on people. It challenges their belief system. So if someone's skeptical, maybe that's for the better.
Absolutely. So you don't try to convince them or change them?
No, not at all.
Have you ever been a witness to an exorcism?
Not necessarily an exorcism. A minor rite of exorcism, yes, but not a full-scale exorcism, no.
Do you believe in demons?
I do, yes.
What do you think they are?
That's a very interesting question. I guess that's a wormhole we could go down for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
But it does seem, when you're dealing with a case, I guess that you could, classify as demonic. A lot of the rules really do seem to apply. I've seen it firsthand. I've seen a minor rite of exorcism performed. I saw what the prayers did to the individual. And of course, the telltale signs of those type of hauntings, there does seem to be that stereotype that does hold water and oftentimes does lead into these type of, of hauntings. So there's definitely something to it.
Did any of your crew members ever get to a point where they said, Steve, we're leaving. I don't want anything to do with this.
Yes. There was a couple of times that did happen.
What freaks them out?
Well, one case that comes into mind, a haunting on Finn Road, one of my documentary films, it was a very dark case. They believed that it was a result of one of their brothers performing satanic practice and other dark arts in the house, as well as a series of other events. And a lot of really strange things were happening. It was affecting people's moods while we were there. There was a lot of tension. Sometimes it just felt like there was some lost time, kind of just a really bizarre encounter of feeling. And I remember one of the sound people just flat out quit. Right. It's actually in the documentary. He just interrupted the interview process and just said, I'm out of here.
Wanted nothing to do with it.
Wow. Yeah, there's voices coming out of the walls. I don't know what's happening here. I just saw something move. I didn't sign up for this. This isn't worth it. And he just quit right on the spot.
Do people invoke the name of Jesus or religion or anything when these things are happening?
You know, the only time that that's happened is when we worked with a demonologist, you know, specifically for a case like that. That's not something as an investigator that I would just do at, you know, at random to provoke or anything like that, no.
Do you know Bill Bean by any chance, an expert on exorcisms?
I don't know him personally, but I certainly know of him.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and we've come across that. What do you think of the devil?
Well, that is a very interesting question. You know, is the devil a specific entity? Is it a collective of evil? You know, at the end of the day, I think that evil is definitely a real thing. I think that, you know, it's void of light. It's void of love. It's, I guess, the purest form of negativity, right? I guess maybe that's part of the balance of this world. But I think it's real. And I think that people need to be aware of that, especially people that are investigating the paranormal, and just always have, you know, good intentions with what you're doing. Stay guarded and, you know, and be strong.
Well, with Steve Shippey, filmmaker, paranormal expert, host of the Travel Channel show, Haunting in the Heartland. Is the Heartland haunted any more than the East or West Coast?
Well, I don't know that it's any more haunted, but I think, you know, the reason that I chose to investigate that particular part of the country is I feel most comfortable there, I guess you could say, you know, being from the Midwest, kind of more of my stomping grounds. It's easier for me to build a rapport with people there. I know a lot more of the cases in this area. And, you know, needless to say, I think that the East Coast has been investigated and is investigated so much, you know, that I just kind of thought, well, you know, let me just carve a little path here for myself and where I feel most comfortable.
Are you a Detroit Tigers fan and Detroit Lions fan?
I'll admit it, yes.
Yep, me too. My poor son, who is now a Detroit Lions fan, I got him turned on to the Lions when he was a little baby boy, still says, "Dad, why'd you do that to me?" But it's a great state. I mean, it really is. My mother's still there. She's going to be 92 in May, Steve.
Oh, wow.
And she's very spiritual. She's very spiritual. Do you come across many people who might not be religious, but they're very spiritual about all of this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, maybe more often than not, especially people that a lot of people in the field seem to be that way. They may not have a specific religion, so to speak, you know, that that we're more used to, I guess, or but more spiritual, more energy based, things of that nature.
Do you think Ed Gein during his day was abused by his mother, at least verbally?
100%.
She destroyed him, didn't she?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, you're discussing religion. I mean, she would use religion, almost kind of weaponized it against, you know, against Gein, Ed, and basically, you know, made him feel that everything was a sin, everything he thought, you know, people were all terrible sinners, and women more so. That's kind of what she instilled in him. So he had a pretty distorted view. I mean, me myself, I would never think humans are inherently evil by any means. I think people can do wrong, but I think inherently we're all good at core. I would like to think so.
He died in 1984, but had he been alive and you had a chance to interview him, what would you ask him?
Man, that's a deep one right there. I guess what I would ask him out of a million questions, but if I had one, I would really want to ask him specifically, why the skin suit? What were you trying to achieve? Why did you create this? Why would you wear something like this?
And I wonder what his answer to you would be. I don't think he'd deny it, would he?
Oh, no. He wouldn't deny it at all. I just really wonder what, you know, it seemed to me that really is what was driving him is using the skin of his victims. I mean, he was upholstering chairs with it and using skin on lampshades. Whatever that bizarre fascination mm-hmm. with human flesh, I really wonder what drove him.
He was convicted of killing two women. Do you think he killed more?
Personally, yes, I do. I mean, you know, as we were out there in Plainfield, Wisconsin, you know, talking to the locals and kind of digging into the reports and reading everything, there were a few women that had gone missing in the area, you know, within, you know, 30 to 60 mile radius.
Yeah.
That was during that heyday when Gein was committing these crimes. There was nothing linking Gein to that, but at the same time, I mean, it really makes you wonder.
Had he not committed any murders, but merely dug up graves and did the bizarre things that he did, would he have been convicted of something, but he wouldn't have been in there for the rest of his life.
No, and to be honest with you, I mean, as calculated as he was, and he would really go out of his way. I mean, after he exhumed these bodies, he would make sure that he put the soil back in a manner that you really couldn't detect it. And on top of that, you know, these were freshly buried individuals, typically the same day. And, you know, so, of course, the ground was kind of already dug up a little bit, but he would go out of his way to cover his tracks. I don't know that he ever would have been caught had he had not actually began to commit murder.
Yeah, I think you're right. And then he bragged, as you mentioned. I guess eventually people put two and two together, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically how he was ultimately caught is when he killed Bernice Worden.
That was in 57, you know. 1957 he killed her.
Yeah, her son came back from deer hunting that day. It was actually opening day of deer season. And, you know, Mrs. Worden wasn't there at the store like she should have been. The door wasn't locked. There was blood that, you know, on the ground. So right away they knew something was wrong. And he recalled Gein being in the night before, stating he'd come back the next day. That led the authorities to go speak to him. He wasn't there. They let themselves in the house, and they found her body hanging upside down.
Ugh.
That led into a full-scale search of the house, and they just continued to find more gruesome remains and basically exposing what he'd been doing this whole time in the woods.
Steve, we're going to come back and take phone calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast AM.